This is a serious, if somewhat delicate, question. If economic expansions don't die of old age, what do they die of? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, December the 7th. Good as always to have you along on this Pearl Harbor Day, everybody. Two thoughts with which to begin. Number one, this morning's jobs report, 155,000 new jobs added to this economy last month. The unemployment rate stays at 3.7%. And in light of which, question number two, have we reached, or maybe more cautiously here, are we reaching the economic turning point in this expansion? Lynette Lopez is with Business Insider. John Harwood is with CNBC. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Okay.
So, Lynette, let me start with you and the jobs report. 150, you know, it's nothing to shake a stick at, right? It's 155,000 new jobs, but it's a little soft, and there's a gathering set of evidence that maybe things are slowing down. You agree or disagree?
It was below analyst expectations, and I would like to point out that on average last year, we lost 35,000 jobs a month, and this month we lost 53, I think.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see companies announce layoffs. We're seeing, you know, Wells Fargo, Hasbro, Mattel, GM. It just, you know, 350 jobs here, 1,500 jobs here. But in an economy that's based off consumer consumption, that is right. A big deal.
The jobs number, we should say here, is a net number, right? But John, so to my question with which I began, you know, are we approaching the turning point, do you think, in this expansion?
Well, the expansion's already slowing down. We had 4.2% growth in the second quarter, 3.5 in the third, and we now have expectations for Atlanta Fed says 2.4% in the fourth quarter. It does not look as if we're likely to exceed the 3% growth target the president's talked about. Next year slows down even further because the stimulus from tax cuts and higher spending is going to wane. And I think there is considerable concern that after 2019, we're really going to slow down. We might even fall into recession.
All right. So let's take that then, Lynette, as a jumping off point for the next question, which is also in that list of things affecting the economy is the American trading relationship with China, the president's tariffs. There was much to and fro this week from the president's advisors about whether or not the whole meeting last week in the G20 actually solved anything. There's the Huawei arrest of their CFO. It is still not entirely. It's not even close to settled, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, there's so many things up in the air. The Huawei arrest, it seems the Chinese government is willing to separate from the negotiations going on with trade. It seems like, through all the noise, we're going to get a 90-day respite from just kind of volleys between the United States and China, 90 days where they're going to sit down and try to negotiate. The Huawei thing is a separate thing. We actually don't know exactly the charges that are being brought against the CFO herself, but we do know that they have to do with a violation of sanctions against Iran and that the parties want to separate that from ongoing negotiations. Hopefully they do. And who knows? Because it doesn't even seem like the White House knows. So how could I know?
So, John, look, if Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, called you and said, hey, John, listen, hook me up here. I know you study this stuff. Should I go to China? What do you say?
I'd say probably yes. But I do think that we're in a very uncertain situation. The fact that this case against the Huawei CFO is so fuzzy is an indication that it's not entirely clear. Is this a law enforcement matter? Is this an economic diplomacy step or a political move? And I think that in itself is a bit worrisome to the idea that President Trump and President Xi are going to come to a meeting of the minds.
Yeah, but John, Larry Kudlow, the president's head of his National Economic Council, and Peter Navarro just now on CNBC swore up and down that this Huawei thing had nothing to do with trade. It's not going to affect it at all. Is that possible?
Yes, it is possible. But they need to clear that up sooner rather than later and avoid any impression. You know, there are some administration quotes out there from people saying, well, maybe this will make the Chinese more amenable to bargaining. You mm-hmm. can't use a law enforcement circumstance in that way and expect the Chinese to react favorably to it.
Lynette, super quick, I want to touch on something that happened Wednesday. We talked about it on this program, the inversion of the yield curve, a slight inversion, and everybody kind of got very, oh my God, a recession's coming tomorrow. Give me your like 30-second analysis of the seriousness of that situation.
I don't know it's serious until it keeps happening over and over and over mm-hmm. again. I think we're all sitting on the edge of our seats to figure out whether or not there's going to be a recession. There are still tells. There are still positive tells about the economy. There are negative tells. I am a negative tell person. I'll give you those all day. But we just don't know yet. So I'm a glass half empty, I'd prefer a martini person.
Well, it's a Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
John, another person looking very closely at whether or not a recession's coming is the president of the United States. You wrote this week, actually, about presidents campaigning in recessions. Nobody, I think, since Carter has won campaigning in recession. Is that the deal? And Carter lost, actually. Sorry.
Well, nobody has actually campaigned during an active recession since Carter, and he lost 44 states. The National Association for Business Economics recently surveyed 53 forecasters, and two-thirds of them said they expect a recession by 2020. That would be a very worrisome development for Trump. He's at 40% in the polls right now. He has no political cushion. This is not a consensus view. Greg Mankiw, who advised President Bush, said he thinks it's only 25% chance of a recession. But if it happens, the Bob Mueller problems that are already weighing on this White House are going to get even more worrisome.
Yeah. Carter's approval going into the recession was a lot stronger than Trump's right now.
Right.
So, not a lot to lose there.
Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, John Harwood at CNBC. Thanks, you two.
You bet.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. Wall Street today, a whole lot of no good, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to take another pass at that jobs report we started with today. One particular slice of it, and the notion that maybe, as John and Lynette and I were talking about, that maybe the slowdown has started. We're going to look at something known as the U6 unemployment rate, so numbered, by the way, for its spot on the chart put out by the Labor Department. It measures total unemployment, including people who are what are called discouraged and underemployed workers. It rose 0.2 percentage point to 7.6% last month. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what that all means.
It is typical for these Labor Department numbers to fluctuate a bit month to month. But economist Martha Gimbel at jobsite Indeed.com says the recent uptick in total unemployment and underemployment is significant.
So it's incredibly disappointing that the share of workers who are working part-time involuntarily jumped up this past month. Even if you look over the year, it's really not coming down.
In recent months, some sectors of the economy have faltered, and employers may not have enough business to offer workers the hours they want, says Andrew Chamberlain at jobsite Glassdoor.
Clearly, the housing market is slowing across the U.S. It's just a matter of time before that starts to affect construction. This month might be the first signs of that.
These unemployment measures have returned to pre-Great Recession levels, though not quite to the all-time lows we reached in 1999 and 2000. Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute says employers have more leverage over workers now.
Because the Great Recession went on so long and the aftermath was so deep, employers have grown accustomed to being able to dictate terms, setting the wage rate, setting the hours that they desire, just-in-time scheduling.
That's when employers give workers little notice of their schedule or shorten shifts without a lot of warning. Andrew Chamberlain says one upside of the long recovery, with labor shortages developing, is an uptick in wages for lower-paid workers.
So when we look at the top 10 jobs with the fastest pay growth that we track on Glassdoor, 5 of the top 10 jobs earn less than $36,000 a year.
That includes cashiers, baristas, cooks, delivery drivers, and maintenance workers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Crude oil prices popped just a bit today, 2% or so, after OPEC and its energy allies, Russia, mostly, agreed to cut production by 1.2 million barrels a day. A couple of things about that. OPEC pumps about 33 million barrels a day, just for context there on that cut. Also, one of the world's biggest oil producers, the United States, is not. part of the production cut. So with a nod to the 30% tumble that crude has taken in the past couple of months, Marketplace's Justin Ho looked into how this all might play out.
To be clear, cutting 1.2 million barrels a day is a significant cut, says Brian Scheid at S&P Global Platts.
There was a lot of question about whether or not OPEC would go ahead with any cut, seeing all of the intense pressure that the Trump White House has been putting on OPEC to push prices even lower.
But while OPEC members would love to start jacking up prices, Scheid says today's cuts are more about making sure oil prices stop falling and stabilize. And while oil prices rose today, Sarah Vokshery at SVB Energy International says prices aren't really expected to rise too much in the long run.
Because of expectation for the increase of U.S. production and export capacity.
As in a lot of production and export capacity. In fact, just yesterday, the U.S. became a net exporter of oil for the first time since the 70s and is one of the world's top three producers.
Depending on what day it is, it may be the first, second, or third largest oil producer, along with Saudi Arabia and Russia.
That's energy analyst Barbara Shook. She says the price Americans pay at the pump is less about OPEC cuts and more about other factors, like where you live and how much you pay in gas taxes.
If you normally pay $3 a gallon, this might bring it up a nickel a gallon, maybe.
The OPEC deal has a few more details to be worked out, and Shook says to watch and see whether Russia actually sticks to its production cuts. OPEC is set to meet again in April to see how the cuts are going. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Say what you will about the current state of civic discourse in this country, but it remains true that when real disaster strikes, people are quick to give their time and their money to help out. Giving and supporting people who need food, shelter, clothing, and cash. So it's no real surprise that millions of dollars in donations went to Paradise, California last month after it was basically wiped out by wildfire. We sent Marketplace's Ben Bradford to the center of the relief effort last week to trace the path of one of those donations.
Shep Harper has $100 worth of Target gift cards in his pocket. He's in Winters, California, about 100 miles south of Paradise, and he's standing in line for beer at the local brewery.
I come out here pretty regularly.
It's a benefit put on by city officials. Harper's a retired firefighter himself who says he feels compelled to give.
To help somebody out up in Paradise, you know, that their life could be a little easier right now.
He hands the cards to a volunteer who stuffs them into a lockbox with other donations.
Thank you so much.
Aid groups prefer cash and cards for the flexibility they offer. The benefit ultimately collects $16,000 in both, including Shep Harper's cards, and the city sends it to this small office in downtown Chico, California. Hundreds of checks lie on a small table in the main room of the North Valley Community Foundation, a 9-person operation transformed overnight into the epicenter of local aid activity.
This is like nothing we've ever done before.
CEO Alexa Benson Valavanis says about $10 million, more than its entire 2016 haul, poured in during November alone from small donors and big names like Verizon and NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers.
Now we literally go down with a box, and the entire box is filled with envelopes and checks.
Many foundations act as pass-through organizations, taking a small cut for overhead. This one says it's taking 1 cent on the dollar. Donors are trusting the foundation to identify which aid organizations on the ground can use it best. In the case of the gift cards, that's an even smaller nonprofit. The Chico Posse Foundation is five women, all with other full-time jobs, who began distributing cards to needy families a few years ago. Their treasurer, Peggy Mead, is flipping through a box loaded with cards, possibly even Shep's.
Like crazy.
There's Kmart, Walmart, PetSmart, and Target.
The great ones really are the Visa because they can use it on anything.
Many organizations allow individuals in need to apply online. That's how the Posse found Jessica Rainier. She's a Paradise native who fled the fire relatively late. She recalls sitting in gridlock while both sides of the road were on fire, and later arriving in Chico to see
people just standing on the roads, wrapped in blankets, watching Paradise burn.
Her home survived, but she's not sure in what condition, and she hasn't yet been allowed in.
Can't go back to mine. I can't use my things. I can't sleep in my bed. I can't go there.
And in her haste to leave, not everything she grabbed is useful.
a bike rack with no bike. I took snow boots because they were expensive.
She thinks about what gift cards could help with.
I need like plastic bags, quart size Ziploc bags. Maybe like a windbreaker would be nice for right now.
She begins tearing open her aid packet.
I don't even know. I'm like shaking a little bit right now.
It's $265 in cards, including a few from Target. They could even be Shep's.
It's a big stack.
Having heard Rainier's story, Mead impromptu slides her another $50 card for gas.
Thank you.
Shep's card may have found its way to a person in need, but aid workers say it'll take a whole lot more Shep's for the people in Paradise to make it through a recovery that's expected to take several years. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Coming up,
cats playing piano and skateboard bloopers.
Why YouTube is sticking with what it knows. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials and the Wawa Trombones off 558 points today, 2.2%, 24,388. The NASDAQ down 219, that's 3%, 6969. The S&P 500 dropped 62 points, 2.25%, 26.33. Stocks posted the biggest weekly decline since March, in case you were curious, because I know you were. The Dow off 4.5% for the 5 days gone by. The NASDAQ off 4.9%. S&P 500 down 4.6%. Tech stocks sank today. Apple down 3.5%. Microsoft off 4%. HP, Hewlett-Packard, suffered a 4.5% loss. Amazon, not safe either. It dropped 4.1%. Healthcare also down. United Health declined 2.7%. Cigna down 3.8%. Today, bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus went down to 2.85%. You're listening to Marketplace. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than just keep us on the air. You make it possible for us to grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you trust and to help us make people smarter about the economy and how it affects our lives. And when you give today, the impact of your gift will be doubled thanks to our friends at Candida. So please donate now at marketplace.org to make your donation go twice as far. And thanks.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Miami is hopping with parties and beautiful people this weekend, even more hopping than usual, I guess I ought to say. It's hosting one of the world's most important contemporary art fairs, Art Basel Miami. It's called. Every year, gallery owners, auction houses, artists, and collectors do millions in business before heading home for the holidays. Marketplace's Renata Sago is on the arts beat today.
It took a crate, a large truck, and a lot of rushing for Janelle Marcero to get her 40 by 60 inch photographs to Miami from her studio in Seattle.
We got to FedEx literally like 3 minutes before the deadline was due to ship out for the next day to the gallery.
She's an emergency doctor who moonlights as a photographer. She snaps scenes from the North Pole to Antarctica. This is her first time exhibiting at Art Basel Miami, and for her, the fair is
a perfect opportunity for me to expose the world to my art.
And for the gallery exhibiting her work, it's a chance to bring in big cash. It's asking for as much as $4,500 for her pictures. Sales in the global art market hit $63.7 billion last year, according to research from UBS and Art Basel. Alexander Forbes with the news website Artsy says the Miami Art Fair usually showcases $3 billion worth of art. It's one-stop shopping for buyers who tend to be people with high net worth, financiers, tech execs, entertainers. They give the a frantic atmosphere.
People running in the door and having 15 minutes to decide whether they want to buy the $10 million painting.
But Forbes says the shaky stock market is encouraging buyers to take their time. If sales slide, that causes the most pain for small galleries. Sarah Douglas is editor-in-chief of the industry magazine Art News. She says galleries pay a fee to exhibit at the fair, and it's a big ask for a small gallery.
Let's say, you know, God forbid, you don't sell anything. You could close.
She says the art fair is trying to address that problem starting next year by getting bigger galleries to subsidize smaller ones. I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
In the land of video streaming, Netflix envy might be the phrase of the year, the last couple of years, really. There are those who are making it, Hulu and Amazon, but some other biggies, Apple and Facebook among them, haven't really been able to get a whole lot of traction in the world of expensive marquee on-demand shows. Also on that list, YouTube, which launched its own subscription service called YouTube Red at the time, back in October of 2016. Yet what works for Netflix does not necessarily work for everybody, and now a little bit more than 2 years later, YouTube is planning to scrap its own subscription model and make all of its content, premium content included, free. Natalie Jarvie had the story for The Hollywood Reporter. Natalie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why is YouTube doing this?
I think it's really all about them trying to find the model of programming that works best for them. They've been experimenting with how to get into the Hollywood game for a few years now, and they still just haven't quite hit on what's going to work best for their users.
They have, as do many other in this economy, many other companies in this economy, they have some Netflix envy, right?
They absolutely do. And it's funny because YouTube is a huge streaming platform. But, you know, they're better known for cats playing piano and skateboard bloopers, and they want to be known for premium content.
What happens, though, to the people who are paying whatever it is, $12 a month or something for YouTube Premium?
Well, YouTube Premium is still going to exist. Yeah. The key now going forward is that you don't have to have YouTube Premium if you want to watch the shows that they're making. But if you want to watch them all at once, you'll still be able to do that on YouTube Premium.
But if I'm a little bit patient, I can save myself some money.
Absolutely.
How is that a winning business model for YouTube?
Well, I think it's a signal that the subscription service isn't really working out for YouTube. The ad-supported product is always going to be their first priority.
So if I'm an actor in, just to pick one because I like the name, Cobra Kai, what am I thinking as to my long-term job prospects?
Well, Cobra Kai will continue to exist and run its natural course, I presume. The bigger question is really, what is this going to mean for the next show? When, you know, creators go out to Hollywood and they pitch their show around all the major networks, YouTube used to be part of that conversation. I don't know that it will be anymore.
Ooh, that hurts.
Yeah.
If I'm Susan Wojcicki running YouTube, that hurts.
The challenge is that when Netflix is spending $8 billion on content a year, unless you want to go that far in, it's maybe better to not be kind of somewhere in the middle. It's better to maybe pull back altogether.
If I'm Facebook or Apple, right? So let's get away from the Hulus and the Amazons, right? If I'm Facebook or Apple and I'm not actually really big in the streaming game yet, what am I thinking?
Well, I think that's going to be the interesting question for the next year. We've seen Facebook's about a year into their premium video strategy, and they've just now started to launch a couple of scripted shows. The buzz has not been very high because no one's expecting to go to Facebook to watch shows. Apple has taken a slightly different strategy because they went ahead and they hired these two big name former Sony executives to run their video efforts. And they're buying these huge buzzy shows. They're competing not a dollar amount on the same level as a Netflix, but certainly they're showing that that's where their ambitions are. So the one I would watch would really be Facebook because we'll have to see if they decide that the few kind of tepid attempts that they've had to make TV-like programming, if that's really what they want to be doing going forward.
I want to back you up to something you just said, that people aren't expecting to go to Facebook to see a series or a scripted show. Do you think YouTube suffers a little bit from that, that maybe people weren't thinking that that's where they would go to see a scripted show?
You know, people go to YouTube to watch makeup tutorials and music videos, and it does take a while to change consumer habits and get people used to going to a new place to find something that they could go to a Netflix or an HBO to find.
Natalie Jarmy covers digital and content for The Hollywood Reporter. Natalie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, just because Christmas is in a couple of weeks and it's Friday and maybe something light is in order because, you know, it's been a week. A new poll from Morning Consult and The Hollywood Reporter out this week on this question. Is Die Hard, the Bruce Willis movie released in July 1988 but set during the holidays, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? 62% of the people surveyed said no, it's not. Also, I can independently report that 62% of the people surveyed are wrong because Die Hard is totally a Christmas movie. It is, by the way. It totally is. You know I'm right. The Dow Industrial is off 558 points today, 2.2%. The NASDAQ down 219, that is 3%. The S&P 500 dropped 62 points, 2.33%. About 4.5% on all three major indices across the board this week. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.